First look through this prism required a Descartian compromise. The National Institutes of Health is now planning to greatly reduce the number of chimpanzees used in NIH-funded biomedical research. Many of the chimps are facing early retirement, and as many as 310 of them may be retired to the federal sanctuary system in the next few years. Joining us to talk about the future of animal research is Kathleen Conley. She's the Vice President for Animal Research Issues with the Humane Society of the United States. Welcome, Kathleen.
Thank you so much.
Now, it's my understanding that medical testing for chimps has been banned in almost every other country, with the exception of the United States. Why is the U.S. lagged behind in chimpanzee testing?
Yeah, that is a good question. And in fact, we are the last remaining developed nation using chimpanzees. A number of other countries have ended their use through legislative means or have just chosen not to do so. We are the holdout here in the United States, and we're hopefully moving away from that now. Our country has been very focused on using animals, and we're trying at the Humane Society of the United States to start focusing on ways of doing research without harming animals, especially chimpanzees.
Now, I began my introduction talking about the Descartian compromise because at the very beginning of medical testing, the church was originally very much opposed to it, and the secularists and the churches were battling until René Descartes, who's most famous for I Think, Therefore I Am, came up with this idea that, well, the Bible says animals are different. How are they different? Let's guess that they don't have a soul, and if they don't have a soul, we can do experimentation on them. We can dissect them. We can do other things, and that's allowed for a fairly wide expansion of our knowledge of anatomy and quite a few advances in drug and other technology. Have we moved, though, to a point where a new compromise needs to be made in which animal testing is becoming less and less necessary across the spectrum?
You know, there's been a lot of innovation, and we've seen it in very recent years. The Human Genome Project showed us what can be done in a very short amount of time scientifically. The innovations are booming. We don't need to be relying as much on animals. We would never deny that gains have been made using animals in the past. But we're looking to the future in 21st century science, and I think, you know, we can put our dollars and our mind to using research without animals to get where we need to be in terms of curing diseases. So in the United States, we heavily rely on animals, but 92% of drugs that make it to humans ultimately fail. So 92% failure rate, I don't think anybody would find acceptable. And I think chimpanzees are the first time we've had a critical examination at the specific use of animals, and the scientific community said, you know what, in fact, we don't need to use these animals. So we're just asking for a critical look at whether the animals are working, and is there a better way we could be doing this research?
Is that 92%, is that mainly dealing with phase one testing, or is that only dealing with chimp studies?
No, that's when they go to human studies, they ultimately fail. Yeah, so they pass through all the preclinical animal work and get to human studies, and 92% failure. So I can send you that information if you're interested. It really is an astounding figure.
Oh, I'd love to see that.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
I know. I mean, it was like, okay, how long are people going to get away with this 92% failure rate, you know? So I think, you know, like I said, Dr. Collins at NIH has made, you know, public comments about how this is an unacceptable, it's unacceptable how long it takes, how expensive it is, and how most of them don't end up, you know, working out at the end of the day. And so that's why they're looking to other ways. But
well, 92% is an outstanding figure. It's certainly significant, you would imagine, in any kind of statistical analysis. Can you tell me where you got that figure from?
So that is from the Food and Drug Administration. So that is their own number about drug failure rates. And, you know, you mentioned the National Institutes of Health coming out with a decision yesterday that they plan to essentially move away from chimpanzee use, only use them when critically necessary, found to be critically necessary in retiring many of the animals. Dr. Collins at NIH has been a believer in investing in these alternatives that I spoke of. So they're putting tremendous money into these on-a-chip programs. So this is developing chips with human tissues and cells that are more relevant to humans. So we're definitely seeing a shift away from reliance on animals.
But what about people who would say that a mouse or a chimpanzee is a much better analogy to a human being because it's a fully functioning organism, it's a fully evolved biological creature, And if we're going to do important medical tests, we still need to see how they function in a living, breathing, reproducing, ambulatory animal.
Right, and I think most people automatically probably may assume if they think chimpanzees are being used that we must be using them at a high rate because of how similar they are. They are the most similar to us biologically compared to any other animal, and they have failed time and time again in research. For example, you know, the reason we have so many chimpanzees are about 850 in laboratories today, which doesn't seem like a high number, but we wouldn't have as many as we have today if they hadn't bred a number of chimpanzees for HIV research in the 1980s and 90s, and they ultimately failed as a model. So, you know, they're very similar to us biologically, but they are just different enough that they're not working as a model. And again, we should be investing in more human relevant alternatives. And actually, humans can serve as research subjects, you know, if it's not done in a harmful way, or if you're using clinical studies or epidemiological studies. So there is a lot to be learned without using animals.
So you would be suggesting that humans might be a better analogy to humans than an animal who isn't human?
Absolutely. And, you know, I should stress that I did come from a background. I was a firm believer in using animals in research and worked at a primate breeding and research facility myself for several years, but became very disheartened by how the system was working and felt we could be doing better. So that's better by the animals, better by the science. So that's why I'm working for the Humane Society of the United States today and trying to make these changes, which, you know, we're a very long way away from replacing animals altogether. But I think the chimpanzee issue is shedding light on how we should be critically examining animal use.
I want to ask you about longitudinal effects, because it's one thing to give a shot for the flu, a one-time deal, see if it works, and it's done. It's another thing if you want to have a medicine which is going to be used chronically and will have to live within a person for a number of years or be reapplied a number of times. Can we use another system to get that kind of longitudinal data?
Well, that's even been a problem when using animals. So we're often not getting that chronic information because of the short lifespan. And again, using chimpanzees, even though they're have a long lifespan, they are not similar enough to us biologically to show us accurate results. So, you know, we need to address this issue of how do we find out about chronic effects. Right now, one of the examples of a way of looking at biology is if you do something to a certain cell, what happens to the rest of the cells in the body? These are called biological pathways, and we should be putting together information on these pathways to learn how to tackle these more, difficult issues such as chronic exposure to elements, for example.
So in your ideal world, what might be one of the protocols that we would go through? Would it be the first step is computer modeling, then we might use some kind of stem cell or some kind of genetic testing, and then eventually go on to full-fledged humans? What would your process be?
Well, you know, I always tell everybody it's not a one-on-one replacement either. You don't necessarily have, okay, here's the animal, well, here's the replacement. It's a combination of approaches. It depends on what your questions are, what you're asking. Certainly computer modeling is one way of looking at things. So drug developers, for example, may start off, we're seeing pharmaceutical companies doing what are known as like initial screens for their compounds without using animals. So they use these non-animal alternatives to screen very quickly and determine targets they should be going after. You know, they're moving away from using animals in even later stages. So we're just going to keep pushing that process until this, you know, we have all the tools we need to not be using animals. Like I said, we're far away from the goal, but now is the time to be investing in learning about the biology of humans and, you know, using human cells and things to get us the answers we need.
Moving back to the National Institutes of Health, is this a really good and noble decision, or is this just a practical matter of fact that most science is moving away from it anyway, and they're just facing reality? It's expensive to use and raise and keep these chimps.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it really is a lot more expensive to even just hold these chimpanzees in the barren laboratory settings. It's more expensive, about $20 per day per chimpanzee, more to hold them in a lab than to put them in a sanctuary. We're saying, listen, no one's really using them anymore. They haven't been for quite some time. Let's give these animals the peace and sanctuary that they deserve and save taxpayer dollars. So I think, you know, they made a mistake back in the 80s and 90s by breeding chimpanzees without really knowing whether they were, in fact, useful for HIV research. And I think the writing is on the wall that they are not a good research model and that, you know, we need to retire them. And NIH definitely showed leadership yesterday on wanting to do that by saying we're going to, in fact, retire nearly 90% of the chimpanzees we own. So we're going to work with them to make sure that that happens sooner rather than later. Some of these chimps have been in laboratories caught in the wild and are over 50 years old. So we're feeling a sense of urgency to get those animals to sanctuary.
But that also brings up another problem. A animal which has lived in one environment, in one setting, its whole life, when you release it into another environment, even a controlled environment like a sanctuary, may need to relearn different skills and may need certain types of care because it hasn't learned those adaptive skills that it might need to if given freedom. Is that process being looked into? Is that something that the Humane Society can help with?
Yeah, I mean, that's a very good point. And the sanctuaries really are do have the expertise to address that issue of rehabilitation of the animals. You know, they do rehabilitate. They flourish in sanctuary settings when given the opportunity. It's letting them have choices, letting them on their own terms determine what they're comfortable with, and the sanctuary is giving them the support to do that. There have been studies that show in the human literature about chimpanzees experiencing post-traumatic stress disorder from their lives in the laboratory. So it is a process, but the great news is they do rehabilitate and do flourish once given the opportunity.
Can you tell me anything about that process? How long does it take? What are some of the steps? What are some of the important transitional moments?
Yeah, so it really does vary per chimpanzee based on their experience, their personalities. So it is not a, you know, here's the textbook on how to rehabilitate a chimpanzee. I actually worked in a sanctuary myself and have a lot of cooperate closely with the sanctuaries now as we go through this process. It's just giving them opportunities and letting them take their own time. So one example is at one sanctuary known as Save the Chimps. They put, you know, the dividers that you have in a bank, the ropes that you have to kind of go through to get to the teller window, they put some of those out for the chimpanzees so they'd have something to hold onto when they went onto the grass because they were nervous about stepping onto the grass for the first time. Some of them, if there are walls around, will stick close to the wall and be afraid to touch anything that's not concrete. So it's really just giving them some tools to make them more comfortable, you know, bedding, reassurance from people, reassurance from their companions. And it is a process. The before and after photos are phenomenal from these sanctuaries. You know, they go in with pale faces and hardly any hair, and then a year later, they've gained weight, they have beautiful hair coats, and they have nice dark skin from being out in the sunshine. So there is an incredible transformation, and that's why I am personally so driven to make sure that every one of them gets the sanctuary they deserve.
And so often the socialization also comes through, because I'm imagining many of these chimps don't have a great facility to interact with other animals of their own kind.
Yeah, that's a great question, and there have been chimpanzees who've lived in isolation for long periods of time. In general, the majority of chimpanzees can be socially housed, but every once in a while you get those animals who can only live with a small number of animals or even just one other individual and take longer to rehabilitate and even become comfortable living with another chimpanzee. So again, these sanctuaries do very close assessments and sometimes have to adjust. You know, they think, oh, well, this chimpanzee, sometimes they call them people, you know, have this personality, let's try to put them together. And sometimes it doesn't work out, but they know what to look for and readjust and put them in a better setting. So it's really about paying attention to how they're responding and what they need.
I guess one advantage to reacclimation is that these chimpanzees are used to human beings. So if you have a guide or a human trying to work with them, they're not particularly frightened of them, or at least they're willing to be conditioned or taught by a human.
Right, and sometimes even, you know, so there are chimpanzees used in other ways, such as pets or entertainment. And other than the National Institutes of Health, the Fish and Wildlife Service very recently said they would like to list all chimpanzees as endangered under the Endangered Species Act, because right now captive chimpanzees in the United States are not afforded any protection under the Endangered Species Act, and that would get at these other uses such as pets, where pet chimpanzees do have a more difficult time often socializing because they've been completely raised by humans and had no interaction with other chimpanzees during their life. So they will seek reassurance from humans and actually sometimes see chimpanzees as foreign, you know, to the, or dangerous. So every chimpanzee has a different history, and so you have to really pay attention to what's happened in their history to decide how to best handle their socialization.
Looking at a way to protect chimpanzees and perhaps to set them free. I'm Andrew Hiller for The Prism, and I've been speaking with Kathleen Conley. She's the Vice President for Animal Research Issues at the Humane Society of the United States. Thank you so much.
Thank you.